And so now, theoretically, we are live. We're about to do a Dhammapada video. Test. It's not working. Oh dear. It's doing this again. See, it's got a static thing going on. Or maybe that's because this isn't on. Test. Oh, yeah, that was that. Because it wasn't on. Test. Okay. So here we go. I'm going to record a Dhammapada video. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 112, which reads as follows. Yo ca vasasatang jive kusito hino viryo ekahang jivitang seyo viryarambato dalhang, which means very similar to the last one. A person who should live 100 years lazy and idle with hina virya, with inferior effort. Better is life for one day. Better is one day of life for a person who is steadfast in their effort. Dalhang is unshaken, unrelenting, relentless effort. So here we have an interesting story. It's a story of suicide, a story about suicide. One of these suicide stories that often gets talked about in Buddhist teaching. This one is one of the not so controversial ones. There's not much controversial here. That's quite interesting. We have a story, the monk's name was Sapadasa, which means the snake slave, the snake servant. That's his name. Sapa is snake, Dasa is a servant or a slave. So he was born in Savatthi to a respectable family, and he got in his mind that he would become a monk. Now I think, reading between the lines, this was probably something that cut him off from his family, probably something that his family wasn't very happy about, or maybe reading too much into it, but there's something there. Because it happens that he became quite fed up with the monastic life. He tried practicing meditation, practiced for a while, and he just found it horrible, found it terrible. Suddenly was just inexplicitly was I suppose it's not inexplicitly, but came out of, almost like it came out of nowhere. Suddenly he was dissatisfied and found himself caught between a rock and a hard place. He was still young, but it says it's not appropriate for him to go back to the lay life. So something like he had made his choice in life. And the only thing he could do, if he went back to the lay life, he would have to get a job. He would have to work as a menial laborer. I guess somehow he had lost his station in life. Maybe that was it, is that he had a rank or something, and he lost it. But he couldn't go back to the lay life, because if he did, he'd be shaming his family by having to work an ordinary job, something like that. Anyway, he found himself unable to disrobe. This is quite common for people as they get older. Old monks or monks who ordained when they were people who ordained when they were older, they find that it's very difficult to disrobe, and so they end up staying as a monk, but not being very good at what they do, not being very dedicated. But here he was, a young man who couldn't disrobe, but couldn't bear to stay as a monk. He said, "Death is preferable to remaining a monk." It's kind of shocking, really. Many people I know who are really keen to become a monk, and some people actually are dying to become monks. But it's true, many people out there, even those who think it might be interesting to become a monk, once they become a monk, find it very, very difficult, trying, and find themselves dissatisfied with the life quite easily. So he tried to find a way to follow up on his reasoning. Death is preferable, so he tried to think of a way to kill himself. So he started to think about, started to have suicidal ideation, as we call it today. And so this is a common state, no? Even in this is sort of a description of a state that leads people to suicide, the state of no hope, can't do this, can't do that, no way out. And it's interesting because meditation really provides that way out, right? I mean, it's the third way. Meditation, the middle way could be described as the third way. When you're caught between a rock and a hard place, you can't bear to stay with the way things are, but you can't change. You can't find, you have no way of fixing the problem, right? The problem is unbearable, whatever it is. Your life, your situation, your physical state, your mental state, but you're unable to fix it, unable to change your state. So meditation is like the third path, the way of rising above, in a sense, pulling yourself out of the problem so that it's no longer a problem. So he didn't have this, though. And so he decided that the way out, the third way out, was to kill himself. Of course, we know as Buddhists that's not really a valid way out, because he's still going to have all the same habits and proclivities and so on after he passes away, after he moves on. Anyway, so he started hunting around for ways to kill himself, and the story goes that the monks had caught a very, very, very poisonous snake. And so when he was walking around, and he was walking through the monastery in the morning, he came into the hall and he saw a jar, maybe a glass jar or something, with a snake in it. And he looked at he asked the monks, what's with the snake? Oh, that's a very, very poisonous snake. Yeah, so we have to get rid of it. They had caught it in this jar. It was in the hall. And so he said to them, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" They said, "Well, we've got to go take it far, far away and get rid of it." And this is when I was in Sri Lanka. We had to do this as well. You had to catch them in a jar. It's really funny, you know, people are afraid of snakes and have this, they make them out to be monsters, but they're really simple animals, actually, and they're very easy to deal with if you're smart. People who handle snakes know that you can walk up behind them and grab them by the back of the neck and pick them up, even the most poisonous of snakes, well, for the most part. So if you know what you're doing, walking up to them, if you have a jar, you just cover the glass jar and they might try to get you through the jar, but just make sure that you get them in the jar. It's quite easy to catch them. And so they caught him up, going to take him out, get rid of the, we have to throw it away. And he thinks to him, "Well, here's my chance. I've got a poisonous snake. I'll just let it bite me and that's it." And so he says, "Well, I'll take it. Let me do it for you." I'm like, "Oh, that's kind. Thank you." So he takes the snake from him. And he comes to this moment of truth. He sets the jar down and he looks at it. He says, "I can't take it. I've got to do this." Maybe he tries to meditate and he can't do it, and he's just constantly upset, and maybe he's desirous of things in the worldly life that he knows he can't get. And so he says, "That's it. I can't take it anymore." And he plunges his hand into the jar. And nothing happens. And he looks down, and there's the snake, sort of coiled up around his hand. He shakes his hand around. Nothing. He flicks the snake, pokes its head. Nothing. He starts to get a little bit upset, and he pokes his finger at the snake's nose. And then he takes his other hand, and nothing happens. So he takes his other hand and he pries the snake's mouth open, and he sticks his finger in the snake's mouth, and nothing happens. The snake pulls back and avoids him. And he shakes his head. He said, "That's not a poisonous snake. That's just a common grass snake." And he goes and he throws it away. And then he goes back to the monastery. He goes back to the monks. And they say, "Oh, did you get..." They said, "Did you throw away the snake? Did you get rid of it? You know, make sure that you got rid of it. You know, did you make sure that it was a far ways away, that it's not going to come back?" He's going to say, "That wasn't a poisonous snake. That was just a common snake." "So, no, that was a real poisonous snake. It hissed and rose up, and it made as if it was going to bite us." And he says, "Whatever, I just stuck my finger in the snake's mouth. Why did you do that?" "Well, I'm trying to kill myself." Or he doesn't quite say that, but he said, "I tried to make it bite me, putting it in my finger in its mouth." And the monks were quiet. That's basically, he's saying that he was trying to kill himself. So, okay, interesting. And they didn't understand either. It's kind of a weird thing to say. How could that possibly be? It's an odd occurrence, for sure. Nonetheless, the monk was unsuccessful in trying... Sapadasa was unsuccessful in trying to kill himself. And it happened that he was acting as the barber for the monks, the person who shaved their heads, and so he always had access to razors. And on the full moon day when we shave our heads, so he got out his razors... He had two or three razors, and he shaved the heads of the monks with one and put another one down on the floor. And when he was done and all the monks had left, he picked up the unused razor and he said, "Well, this is a way. I'll cut my throat with the razor. I'll just end it like that." And so the text says that he does something that I guess is a little strange. I'm not quite sure. I think you'd have to have been there to understand exactly what he did. But it says he put his neck against a branch, maybe to support it. I don't know. And then he took the razor to his throat. And then he paused for a moment. And he considered the life he had lived as a monk. You know, just as the last moment, this is it. He said, "Well, what have I done as a monk?" And he realized he'd really actually practiced quite well. His whole time as a monk, he'd followed the duties, followed the rules, practiced meditation, was respectful to his teacher, was respectful to the Buddha, the practice. It was actually quite spotless. And as he thought about it, his mind became calm. He's got the razor against his throat, and suddenly his mind starts to focus, and he enters into a state of meditation, again, almost as though it came out of nowhere. And he enters into a very powerful state of meditation, and then he applies it to his situation, and he feels the razor against his throat, and the branch against his neck, and the mind that is full of discontent. And he watches these, watches them arise and cease, and right then and there he becomes an arahant. It's almost as though it was magic. And he puts the razor down and he walks back to the monks. Well, walks back to the monastery, and they say, Where were you? And he said, "Oh, I took a razor out and I was going to kill myself." It just says that he's an arahant, right? There's no arahat. One of the meanings of arahat means araha. Araha means having. Raha means private or secret. Araha means an arahant has no private side, no secret. They're the same outside as inside. So they don't hide anything. They don't have anything to hide. And he says, oh, I took a razor outside thinking I'd cut my windpipe and kill myself. And he said, well, how are you still alive then? And he says, well, instead of cutting my windpipe, I cut off the defilement with the razor of wisdom. And the monks look, turn to each other and say, oh my gosh, what kind of a lie is this guy telling, right? How is that possible? So they go and tell the Buddha and they say, we got a monk here who thinks he's enlightened or he's lying about it or something. You know, we can't let this stand. And so the Buddha calls this monk up and he says, he doesn't call the monk up. The Buddha listens to them and already knows the truth. So he says to them, you know, the people who are enlightened can't tell a lie. Basically saying he's enlightened, he's not lying. And they say, Bhante, the way you're speaking, it sounds like he's actually enlightened. But how could that be? He was trying to kill himself. He was so discontent. He was discontented about the holy life. And another monk pipes up and says, yeah, and how is it that he tried to kill himself and this snake wouldn't even bite him? You know, what's the story of this guy? Why are these strange things surrounding this monk's life? And like any strange things that occur in anyone's life, they often do have mysterious beginnings. And so we have these two aspects that the Buddha then talks about, what the origins of these two things are. So there's the origins of this snake that refuses to bite the monk. And yes, that's where he gets the name Sappadasa. It's the snake slave. And the Buddha doesn't go into details about that one, but he says that in a past life, that snake was a slave or servant of this monk. And so it was this connection. By this connection, that snake refused to bite, just as his servant, because he was used to being a servant, and he knew that he would get punished if... So it was a reflex action of not wanting to harm. It's very interesting, you know, it's not very karmic. You'd think it would be otherwise if it was karmic, but again, karma is just the impression that our acts leave on our mind. So again, this is an impression that the snake left on his own mind before he was a snake that has now passed into this life. The impression that he should respect his master, respect this other person who was once his master. And then he tells a story, which is also, it's not that big of a story, but the story goes about why he was discontent and how it's possible that he could become an arahant. And it's an interesting little story. There are these two monks in the time of the Buddha Kassapa. The Buddha says, in the time of Buddha Kassapa, there were two monks. One monk was discontent and wanted to leave the monastic life and become a lay person. And he was ready to do it. He had given up the practice. He had given up his duties, you know, he stopped taking care of his possessions and so on. And he came to this other monk and said, I intend to disrobe. And the other monk, being a good friend to some extent, he convinced him, he talked to him and explained to him and reminded him about the problems of being a lay person and how much freer and how much purer it is to live a homeless life, to live a life in a renunciation. So much so that he actually convinced the monk not to disrobe. And the monk was very grateful and thankful. And she completely changed his mind just based on the advice and the support of this other monk. And so he goes back and he says, well, I better try again. And he picks up where he left off. He cleans out his kuti and he picks up all his belongings and finds that his bowl has rusted and some of his metal stuff, because there was no stainless steel back then, so they had to care for your bowl. You have to oil it, actually, to keep it from rusting. And so he went out and he started to do this, started to clean, and he was cleaning his possessions. and he was sitting near the other monk who was maybe eating or doing something. And he says, as he's oiling his bowl and sort of scraping off all the rust and so on, he says, "You know, I was going to give these to you when I disrobed." It's a bad thing to say, because suddenly the other monk, thinking to himself, "If I hadn't have said anything, I would have gotten all this guy's belongings. I guess somehow they were worth having." Or not. I mean, it's very easy to get covetous when you're living a life of renunciation. The smallest thing can grab at you. It's very easy to become attached. So suddenly he became obsessed with these things, and he hitting himself over the head for having a very, really horrible, actually. I mean, it's quite surprising, but, you know, people can be very petty. So he became very petty, and he thought to himself, "Who cares if this guy stays a monk? If I can get him to disrobe, I'll get his stuff." And so from that day on, he started dropping hints and even outright describing the benefits of being a layperson, how good it was, and, you know, how preferable it was, and anything he could do to reignite this other monk's discontent. That's an interesting story. And then the other monk was really started to become discontent, but then he started to think to himself, you know, why is this guy now, you know, before he was so good at keeping me in the monastic life, now he's making me want to quit again. And then he thought to himself, it was after I told him about my requisites, after I told him about my belongings. And that's the end of the story. It doesn't elaborate beyond that, which is very typical of these stories, that they're not really interested in the narrative or making it flow. They just want to give information, and they'll just stop abruptly like that. So that's where the story ends. Now, he was the monk who was discontent. The Buddha does say he was the monk who was discontent. So that karma of cultivating the habit of being discontent followed him into this life. But I guess ostensibly the story ends there. It seems likely that he didn't leave the monastic life. The Buddha says something about how he spent many, many years in meditation. So assumedly that's after that fact. He realized that he was being conned, and maybe tried to find better friends and continue on in his meditation. Because of that, so those two things, the two aspects, this proclivity towards wanting to disrobe, but also the powerful meditation that he'd done, that's what came together. So suddenly, in this last life, he continued that desire. When he became a monk, immediately it was a recognition, oh yeah, this is that thing that I hate, that thing that I don't want to do. And so that consumed him in the beginning. But the awesome karma that he had of practicing meditation, that when he tried to escape, when he tried to leave by killing himself, it came up, it bubbled up as well, and propelled him directly, quite quickly, to enlightenment. And the Buddha told this story, these stories. And then the monk said, wow, that's amazing. So it really is possible to become a monk, to become an arahant that quickly. And the Buddha said, oh, yes, of course, a monk, a meditator who strives with all their might can become enlightened by when they lift their foot up, can be enlightened before they, be enlightened when their foot touches the ground, or can be enlightened even before their foot touches the ground. So meaning one step, you can become enlightened. For it is better, and then he says, it is better for a man who strives with all his might to live but a single instant than for an idle man to live 100 years. And then he tells this verse. Better to live one moment, one day. Better to live one day with effort than to be lazy for 100 years. So the key here is effort. Effort in Buddhism is interesting because it is possible to have too much effort, just as it's possible to have, not too much, but a predominance, sort of an excess dominance of effort or concentration, and they have to balance each other. So by effort here, and by effort in Buddhism, is actually meant something quite specific, and not precisely effort in the sense that we understand it, like just pushing yourself. Effort here is directed effort, or effort directed in the right direction. It has to be accompanied by wisdom. It has to be accompanied by mindfulness. So it's the effort to straighten the mind, the effort to give up unwholesome crookedness of mind, the effort to prevent the mind from becoming crooked, to keep the mind straight. There are four parts. To give up unwholesomeness in the mind when we have defilements, to prevent unwholesomeness from arising, to cultivate wholesomeness in the mind, and to maintain wholesomeness. So we have different mental qualities. Meditation, one way of looking at it is it's the adjusting of this balance, cultivating more positive and rooting out the negative. And by positive we mean beneficial, wholesome, helpful, good qualities of mind. By the negative we mean unwholesome, leading to suffering, leading to harm, leading to evil, things lead to problems. So our meditation starts with just looking and learning, really mindfulness. It's not about judging, it's about looking and learning, but then the judging comes through the wisdom. The judging comes from a point of view that is able to see clearly. Once you can see clearly, then your judgments, the things that you cultivate and the things that you abandon, they are based on wisdom, right? Because we have partialities in our life and judgments in our ordinary life without mindfulness, but they're based on delusion, they're based on confusion, they're based on misperception and wrong view. Once you practice meditation, all it's doing is focusing, creating clarity in the mind, so that your judgments are based on clarity. You don't have to judge, you don't have to actively figure out what is right, what is wrong, you don't have to feel guilty or anything. Look clearly, you'll see what is right and wrong. You won't have to question. You'll see what leads to suffering, you'll see what leads to happiness, you'll see what changes the mind for the better, and you'll see what changes the mind for the worse. That's what effort, true effort is. Effort is this sort of work that is done. You know, if you talk about right effort, it means to practice mindfulness. It means to actually practice. So get off your butt and sit on your butt. It's like you have to get up and sit down. Like this funny saying, there's another one, don't just do something, sit there. It's a very Buddhist thing to say. And that's important, because effort is not just doing something, it's not just working. And like Henry David Thoreau says, like a man, like these men in the field who move rocks around in their field, and they're constantly removing rocks from their field. He's talking about like Sisyphean labors. Like Sisyphus was this guy who pushed this rock up the mountain, and when it got to the top, it would roll back down, and so he was constantly pushing it up. And yet in the world, and that's considered, you know, an example of a useless labor, so we use the word Sisyphus. Sisyphean, I think. I got that right or not. To describe some useless endeavor, some hard work. And yet in the world we often do work that turns out to be useless, turns out to be pointless. You know, like me writing this essay this week. Not exactly true. I'm writing an essay on free will, which is an interesting thing, interesting topic, and it's something that philosophers have discussed. And probably the most interesting thing you can find is that people have a very hard time with it. It's something that is very hard to pin down. Anyway, totally unrelated. But the point being, effort can be useless, and for effort to be right effort and to be the effort the Buddha is talking about, it simply means the effort to adjust, the effort to straighten the mind. Like we've seen before, that novice Pandita Samanera, who saw them directing water, saw them straightening the arrow shaft, and he realized what's most important is to straighten the mind. So that's what this means. A person who is has right effort and has a mind that is sharp and strong and fixed and focused. Better that they live one day than an ordinary person who lives 100 years. So the question is, how do we become that person? You know, Sappadasa had a big head start. And so it's not to be discouraged if you're that person still. It's just a reminder of where we should be. You don't have to work really hard, work. It means you have to balance your mind. You have to be mindful. You have to cultivate this rectitude, this upright state of mind. That's what we do in the meditation, where you remind yourself seeing, or pain. Your mind is straight in that moment. That's right effort, right concentration. It's all in there. Just like the ingredients in a medicine. All the ingredients come together, you just have to take one pill. You don't have to go looking for each one. So all of these, that's why each one of these verses is correct. The one talks about wisdom, the one talks about morality, the one talks about effort, and we've still got a couple more to go. But all of them are correct because they all refer to aspects of the same thing, different ingredients in the same pill. The pill is the practice of meditation, of cultivating clarity and understanding, knowledge, true knowledge, empirical understanding, empirical realization. So, that's our Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Keep practicing. Be well. Good night. Okay. Now I have to turn everything off. We need this light either, do we, or is it good to have that on? Maybe not. Different color. Okay, so now we will broadcast live video. Just in 1 second. How are we doing for that? Start. Now we're going live. Hello. Good evening. Welcome to our live broadcast. Again, we're starting late because I've just done a Dhammapada video. So if you want to listen live to that, you can listen live to it. But I don't want to record a video for it twice, so we're starting late. If you wanted to get from the beginning, you should go to meditation.sirimangalo.org. And that's where we have our live group. That's where you can ask questions as well. And you'll have an audio feed through the whole of the broadcast, including the Visuddhimagga, including the Dhammapada teaching. So, a couple of announcements, right? At least one. That today we had 10 people come to our weekly meditation group, which is more than usual. Some old, we had 4 returnees, I think. Yeah, four old, 6 new. And we're planning on putting up posters. So we'll put up a whole bunch more just black and white posters saying, what are you waiting for? Because the exams are coming up, so people should learn to meditate. And this Friday we're gonna try again with the meditation mob thing. And just have a small group of dedicated people in the main student center room. I think I had another announcement. Robin, do you have any more announcement? Any announcements?
No. Not until we get a little more information, maybe on the children's home in Florida.
Right, so we're working on that. We have a meditator coming to stay, Vanessa, who is an old meditator of friend who first, well, old, fairly old, from Sri Lanka. She came to Sri Lanka. She's from Europe. Don't ask me which country. I want to say Austria, but I can't remember. She'll be here Saturday. She just emailed me or messaged me or something, asking if she needed to bring white clothes. And no, we're not requiring white clothes. Maybe we should, but we're not. Maybe we should talk about that.
I think it's technically it's in the rules, but we
Is
can
it?
just adapt the rules to say optional if you want.
Oh, that's right. But that was because that was a Cambodian monastery. I'm not fickle about, I'm not pushy about that. I mean, what's the deal with white clothes? It's a nice tradition. Maybe it is something we should consider. It is a nice tradition. It's just hard. I mean, then you're forcing people to go out and buy clothes just so they can practice meditation because no one has white clothes. It was more of a thing in India because that was accepted and finding white clothes was not difficult, I think. It was just they were uncolored. And there is a point to that because people come with bright, you know, in India it was a big thing to have brightly colored clothes like a peacock. Even now they have these bright saris and, you know. So that's kind of a no-no. But if you're just using, maybe we could say neutrals. And it has to be, the other thing is it has to be, what's the word? Conservative? No, what's the word? Modest. We had one, oh, in Jomtong, when I was at Jomtong, the kind of people that would come, we had one woman come with a skirt that had a slit all the way up to her, I don't know what you call it, but you could almost see her underwear. Well, quite high slit on the side. And she, you know, tried to walk around like that. A young, fairly attractive woman, I think. And the old nuns were not happy about that. We had another man wearing some kind of Middle Eastern. It's like a big nightshirt, you know, those nightgown, a nightgown kind of thing. It was that kind of thing, but I think it's from the Middle East. Just a white one piece, and that was all he was wearing. I don't even think he had underwear on underneath. So this is the kind of thing you get. I think that's also a no-no. But like women wearing skin-tight shirts, that kind of thing, not really appropriate. But when I was in Manitoba, when it was hot, you know, really hot in the summer, and what I had one meditator staying with me, and she wore shorts that were just above the knees. You know, they were actually quite long shorts, and people got really upset about that. And I was kind of thinking, you know, it would be nice if she was wearing pants, but it was so hot that I never said anything. And it actually became a bit of an issue. People were not happy about, you know, traditional Buddhists were not happy about it. But you know, in Canada, who thinks twice about cargo shorts, right? What is considered modest here and what is considered modest in Asia, two very different things. Not that it's there's not a point there, because showing your legs off is showing your legs off, and there is potential there. You know, just because cleavage is acceptable doesn't mean it's not going to arouse emotions that are problematic in a meditation center, that kind of thing. So there are issues to talk about. I'm not disregarding those. But yeah, so we'll have Vanessa will be here. And then we have a man named Timu coming, hopefully. There was another man, John, who was supposed to come, but I think he's got problems with visas. We had our first graduate, I forgot to mention, yesterday. Not quite graduate, but the first person to go through the entire online course. It means he's not finished. He still has to come here and finish the course. But that's the thing is, he now has to come here and finish. So that's a landmark of sorts, sort of.
Anumodana.
Yeah, so his slot is available. If you notice, I think he's taken himself off, has he? Actually, I'm not sure. When was that? That was yesterday, right? Yeah, so yesterday there's a Tuesday slot available now.
Yes.
but he's already planning to come up here to finish the course next January, maybe in January.
Actually, it looks like there are three available now. Mm-hmm. So if anyone is looking, there's three.
Yeah, if somebody wants to start this online course, we'll have to see. We'll have to get some feedback as to how useful it is. People seem to be getting benefit from it. No, it's not the same as doing an intensive course, or not the same as being in the presence of meditators and being with your teacher, that kind of thing, but it's what we got. It seems to be useful. Just having that, you know, just having someone to prod you and to remind you and hanging over your head, oh, I've got to meet with my teacher, so I better meditate, kind of thing. It's quite useful.
Maybe good preparation for going to do the last part in person. You know,
yeah,
just...
I'm skeptical. I mean, it's not the best preparation. I'm not sure how long it's going to take people to finish it. But what we have seen is people who have done that take about a week and can do the course in a week. A week is cutting it short, so preferably it would be like 10 days. But if you had 10 days, 9 days, right? That's what we prefer, is 2 weekends. So if you had 9 days, really that weeks and weeks of training is a good preparation for the actual course. But you'd need about 9 days. We just don't want to throw you right into hardcore intensive practice, so we have to build it up, because even with all that practice, you've still never done a full day of meditation, theoretically. We have another two questions. One is whether this online course, we have to get people to sign a waiver. So we have to discuss that. Maybe we do, right? And two, I'd like to get everyone's commitment to keep rules. So at least 5 precepts, right? Shouldn't be doing this course if you're still drinking alcohol, that's for sure. But the 5 precepts you should be keeping if you're going to do this course. But I think I haven't talked to people about that. That's my bad. I should have. So maybe from now on I'll ask everyone, I'll remind everyone, okay, we're starting something new. But what about the waiver, Robin?
Well, we were discussing that, and currently we put on the website the center rules for when you're there in person, mm-hmm. and also some frequently asked questions, and you know, more so geared toward the residential part of it. But there's also a meditator application and waiver, again geared toward the residential. But there was discussion about maybe it would be good to have the online meditators sign that as well.
Maybe I'll ask my father what he thinks. He's a lawyer.
Sure.
Yeah, and he's very concerned with those sorts of things. I remember we were trying to play paintball on his land, and he wouldn't let us, or he almost wouldn't let us, because, you know, liability.
Yeah, it's a big thing, liability.
Anyway, that's a bunch of boring stuff. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes. Bhante, will you be doing anything in Florida? Which part will you be staying in?
I'll be in Tampa area. Dunedin is where I'll be staying. But yeah, we'll be doing at least a one-day course at the Florida Buddhist Vihara. It's on their website. So if you go to the Florida Buddhist Vihara website, I'm pretty sure they've got an event. And don't ask me which day, because I forget.
I can link that post. Actually, this one is dated June of 2014, so it seems to be the outdated one. Oh, here's the one. December 26, 2015.
26th, so Boxing Day.
Oddly, I'm trying to send the link there and it seems to be frozen up, but I'll try that again in a moment. Hello, Bhante. Although we are encouraged to ask questions and talk about our problems, and of course we all experience various problems or difficulties, but I'm interested to know, as you are a very experienced practitioner, are there any parts of the practice that you still find difficult? Brilliant, yeah. Dhamma talk as usual.
I don't really talk about my own practice. Sorry. There's just too many problems associated with it. Doing so.
I seem to be having a little trouble with my meditation website here. It's frozen up. I'm just going to grab my phone. Okay, that was it for the questions, Bhante.
Right, well, we had the Dhammapada, so that's Dhamma for tonight. Let's just stop there then, okay?
Thank you, Bhante.
Thank you, Robin, for your help. Good night, everyone.
Good night.